Ever since the beginnings of human intelligence, thoughtful people have had principles and have found that the social world they inhabit just doesn't measure up. Throughout the world, it is accepted and even expected that intellectuals speak of their ideas about the pressing issues of the day. In the United States as well, intellectuals like Henry David Thoreau and W.E.B. Du Bois have taken measure of their society and have found it wanting. Thoreau, Du Bois, these are intellectuals who have lived for the mind. Live for the mind? It means that it is surely worth living a life devoted to freely chosen intellectual and artistic pursuits, pursuits which ultimately express our ethical principles. Noam Chomsky, professor of linguistics at MIT, has been living for the mind in many, many senses of that phrase. He has developed the theory that a universal human grammar for all languages is an innate capacity of the creative human mind. In our library, there are some 90 of his books. In works like Hegemony or Survival, Professor Chomsky reasons carefully and asks critical questions whenever the United States tries to use military force to get its way in Iraq, Cuba, Central America, or elsewhere. Professor Chomsky has been a critic of state elites who, rather than living for the mind, dismiss the mind. We must be wary of state elites who, in their work, use intelligence, yet suppress critical judgments and principles in themselves as well as in other people, to further the power of the centralized state. Tonight, it's my great pleasure to introduce Noam Chomsky, who will speak to us about democracy promotion, reflections on intellectuals and the state. Professor Chomsky, thank you.
Enjoyed the music as much as I did, but I'm afraid this is going to be a little more somber. Begin with the opening words of the most extensive article in an American scholarly journal on the roots of the Bush Doctrine. That's the title of the article. Opens by stating that the promotion of democracy is central to the George W. Bush administration's prosecution of both the war on terrorism and its overall grand strategy. Now, the statement is unsurprising. In fact, by the time it was written, 2005, it had really reached the level of ritual, sometimes given a broader sweep. So in Britain's leading Journal of International Affairs, the major article on the same topic adds, I'm quoting, that promoting democracy abroad has been a primary U.S. goal ever since Woodrow Wilson endowed U.S. foreign policy with a powerful idealist element, which gained particular salience under Reagan and has been taken up with unprecedented forcefulness under George W. Bush. And in journalism and commentary, it's taken to be the merest truism, just presupposed or stated off the cuff. Well, that description of the Bush Doctrine is of obvious importance. It's adopted with something approaching unanimity. And in that case, any rational person will want to see the evidence on which it's based. And the results of an inquiry into that question tell us quite a lot about the state of democracy. So to take an extreme example, suppose that a similar declaration were produced in, say, North Korea. Well, we wouldn't even trouble to investigate the evidence. it suffices that the dear leader has spoken, so that ends the discussion. It's true. Well, in democratic cultures, in contrast, substantial evidence would be demanded for an important thesis like that, and serious argument refuting apparent counter-evidence. Now, what I'd like to do in this talk is to review the evidence. I think I'll try to keep it to be a fair sample on that quite crucial matter, and just to state the conclusions in advance so you know where I'm going, I think, which you can guess already, I think that the evidence against the mantra is mountainous, and the evidence for it consists almost entirely of declarations of noble intent. And if that's even roughly accurate, I think it's much more so. And if it sounds like North Korea under conditions of freedom, it should disturb those who care about their country and want to do something about it. Well, let's begin with the most recent empirical test of the doctrine, the elections in Palestine last couple of weeks. Just a very brief word on the background. In 1996, Yasser Arafat was elected president in a well-supervised election, supported by the United States and Israel. And the reason was he was then fulfilling his role, namely as their policeman in the territories, controlling the population, while the United States and Israel pursued their settlement and development programs in the occupied territories, which are very clearly designed to take over the valuable land and resources and keep a stranglehold on any scattered areas that they might ultimately leave to Palestinians. By the year 2000, Arafat had lost U.S.-Israeli support. He was not accepting their demands, and he was not controlling the population while the process continued. Accordingly, the one democratically elected leader in the Arab world was locked up in his compound in Ramallah, and the U.S. and Israel would not permit the new elections that the population demanded and that were scheduled. Now, the reasons were quite frankly explained. If there were elections, the wrong man would win. Arafat's death was greeted with great joy, unconstrained and unconcealed, because it opened the way to realize the president's messianic mission of bringing democracy to the region. Quoting from the most liberal press, but that's misleading because it was near universal. There was a think piece on the front page of the New York Times just after Arafat's death. The headline was, "Hoping Democracy Can Replace a Palestinian Icon." And the article opens with these words, "The post-Arafat era will be the latest test of a quintessentially American article of faith, that elections provide legitimacy even to the frailest of institutions." Opening paragraph on the front page. Final paragraph on the continuation page, we read, "The paradox for the Palestinians is rich, however. In the past, the Bush administration resisted new national elections among the Palestinians. The thought then was that elections would make Mr. Arafat look better and give him a fresher mandate and might help give credibility and authority to Hamas." So in brief, the quintessential article of faith is that elections are fine as long as they come out the right way. Actually, those of you, I know this is a big center of journalism, so maybe you can answer a question for me that I often wondered about. It's very common, I found, in reading articles like this, that the final paragraph says something significant, and that the first paragraph is propaganda. And that's one of the reasons why I usually start reading articles with the last paragraph on the continuation page and then work my way up. And I've often wondered whether journalists do that on purpose. assuming that the first paragraph is going to be for the headline writers, and that's the one that the editors will look at, and maybe readers who get down to the end of the continuation page might be interested enough to know something. Interesting question. I leave it to you. Exercise. Let's now turn to the past few weeks. There was an election. It was permitted on the assumption that the U.S. candidates would easily win. However, as the election day approached, it was becoming clear that the outcome was not certain. So therefore, Washington resorted to a standard methods of subversion. Immediately before the elections, USAID initiated development programs in an effort, I'm now quoting the Washington Post and the New York Times, in an effort to increase the popularity of the Palestinian Authority on the eve of crucial elections in which the governing party faces a serious challenge from the radical Islamic group Hamas, spending millions of dollars on quick projects to bolster the governing Fatah faction's image with voters and strengthen its hand in competing with the militant faction Hamas. That's the national press. Well, in the United States, or any Western country, even a hint of such foreign interference, particularly from a long-standing enemy, would totally destroy a candidate. But deeply rooted imperial mentality legitimates such routine measures of subversion of elections elsewhere, without comment, because it's our right. The attempt resoundingly failed. So we next turn to the next phase, now underway. But let me just back up slightly. On February 12th, the New York Times had a review by constitutional law professor Noah Feldman of Iraq fame, as you may remember. It was a review of a book of collected declarations of Osama bin Laden. And the review runs through his descent from merely horrible to ultimate evil. It goes step by step. And finally, you read the review, he reached the ultimate lower depths. Quoting the review, he said, "Osama made the perverse claim that since the United States is a democracy, all citizens bear responsibility for its government's actions, and civilians are therefore fair targets." Okay, that's plainly ultimate evil. 2 days later, the lead article in the New York Times announced that the United States had joined Osama in the lower depths of evil. The article reported U.S.-Israeli conclusion that all Palestinians bear responsibility for their government, so all civilians are fair targets and must suffer for electing Hamas. That's Osama's perverse claim. Palestinians, the article explained, and many follow-up ones, will be held hostage and punished until they elect a government favored by the United States and Israel. And a series of specific mechanisms are outlined, which I won't review. You can read them in the newspapers, as some of them already in effect, others continue. Last week, Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice was traveling through the Middle East in an effort to convince the Arab states and not to compensate for the funding cuts that are intended to starve the population into submission. Well, she failed. They don't understand democracy there. In fact, only the European Union, which is easily intimidated, is willing to go along even partially. That leaves the United States and Israel in splendid isolation in adopting Osama's perverse doctrine. And in fact, for those of you who know the history, that's pretty much the way it's been for the last 30 years. Well, I don't want to pursue too many tangents, but understanding oneself should always be a very high priority. So perhaps it's worth noting something that was missed in the review of Osama's descent to utter barbarism. something was missed that one might imagine a respected law professor at NYU might know, as well as the editors of the New York Times. What was missed is that Osama's perverse claim has been official U.S. doctrine for years, often stated in virtually those words. Now, there's case after case, which there's no time to review here, but I ought to mention at least the classic example, which everyone ought to know, and that's Cuba. The United States has been running campaigns of terror and economic strangulation against Cuba for over 45 years, and the reasons are explicit in the internal record. Very free country, we have access to internal records, unusually so. So if we don't know about what our government is up to, that's by choice. We have more access than any country in the world. So you go back to the Eisenhower administration. The high officials of the Eisenhower administration explained, I'm quoting, that the Cuban people are responsible for the regime, so the United States has the right to impose sanctions, because if the Cuban people are hungry, they will throw Castro out. Kennedy came into office shortly after, and he agreed that the embargo would hasten Castro's departure as a result of what he called rising discomfort among hungry Cubans. And to expedite that outcome, he also launched a major campaign of international terrorism. Well, so it continued. The punishment of the people of Cuba for their crime intensified when Cuba was in dire straits after the collapse of the Soviet Union. The author of the 1992 congressional legislation to tighten the blockade proclaimed that, as he put it, my objective is to wreak havoc in Cuba so that the people will suffer and force government policy to change. That's liberal Democrat Robert Torricelli. The basic thinking was expressed right at the beginning by Deputy Assistant Secretary of State Lester Mallory in 1960. He wrote that Castro will be removed through disenchantment and disaffection based on economic dissatisfaction and hardship, so every possible means should be undertaken promptly to weaken the economic life of Cuba in order to bring about hunger, desperation, and the overthrow of the government. And the basic thinking has not changed since, and the doctrine has been repeatedly applied in many countries. So what's happening in Palestine is not at all novel, though it has obvious implications, in particular concerning the messianic mission. Well, there are, of course, reasons given for why the U.S. must adopt Osama's perverse claim and sink to the depths of ultimate evil. The reasons are that Hamas's announced objectives are intolerable, and actually a pretty good case can be made for that. But it's worth noticing that in basic respects, they are more forthcoming than the policies of the United States and Israel. And these policies are not just words, but they're being implemented. Well, again, time's short, so I leave that as an exercise for you, one very much worth pursuing. Maybe we can return to it in discussion later. Well, let's turn elsewhere. January 2005, Iraq held its first elections. They were very warmly welcomed by the government, the government of Iran, that is. The foreign minister of Iran declared, quoting him, that Iran supports the wishes of Iraqi citizens for a democratic government, a fully sovereign Iraq in a stable and peaceful region of democratic states. Okay, rational observers will view Iran's dedication to democracy promotion with perhaps a shade of skepticism. The same is true when Bush and Blair and Rice and their associates issue similar pronouncements. In fact, it's far more clear in their case for reasons that it takes some effort to ignore. The most glaring of these reasons is, in fact, occasionally articulated, though very rarely. One of the few who broke ranks on this is a
well-known Middle East scholar, Augustus Richard Norton, who commented accurately that as fantasies about Iraq's weapons of mass destruction were unmasked, the Bush administration increasingly stressed the democratic transformation of Iraq, and scholars jumped on the democratization bandwagon, journalists even more so. Before the fantasies were unmasked, there was, of course, occasional invocation of the standard pieties about love of democracy, but not beyond the usual meaningless norm. The most extensive scholarly study of official justifications for the Iraq invasion by intelligence analyst John Prados, such terms as democracy are notable by their absence, in fact, not even indexed. Well, to put it plainly, if perhaps impolitely, while asking us to appreciate the sincerity of their eloquent orations about the sudden conversion to democracy promotion, U.S. and British leaders are also informing us that they are among the most brazen liars in history. They drove their countries to war on the grounds of what they insistently called a single question. Will Saddam abandon his weapons of mass destruction programs? Well, by August 2003, when the tail was falling to pieces, the New York Times reported that as the search for illegal weapons in Iraq continues without success, the Bush administration has moved to emphasize a different rationale for the war against Saddam Hussein, using Iraq as a linchpin to transform the Middle East to vibrant democracies, the new mantra. Everybody else went along. Well, that alone suffices to undermine the credibility of the different rationale, but that's only the bare beginning. Nonetheless, it quickly became holy writ. Its sincerity passed beyond challenge after the president's address, well-publicized address at the 20th anniversary of the National Endowment for Democracy in Washington. It's November 2003. The title was Freedom in Iraq and the Middle East. The single question had by then been dispatched to oblivion, replaced by Bush's messianic mission to bring democracy to the Middle East, so that the president's Iraq venture may be, I'm quoting, the most idealistic war fought in modern times. It's David Ignatius, the veteran correspondent, former editor of the Washington Post. Considerable effort, I've found only the rarest of exceptions to this stance in media and intellectual commentary, although there are indeed critics who warn that what they call the noble and generous vision may be beyond their reach, may be too costly, the beneficiaries may be too backward, not ready for democracy. Actually, evidence for that conclusion was provided just as President Bush formally revealed his messianic mission at the National Endowment for Democracy anniversary celebration. Right at that time, a Gallup poll was taken in Baghdad, and it offered respondents the opportunity to leap on the democratization bandwagon, along with about 100% of commentators here. But in Baghdad, some failed to do so, 99%. Asked why they thought the United States invaded Iraq, 1% felt that the goal was to bring democracy. 5% thought that the goal was to assist the Iraqi people. Most of the rest assumed that the goal was to take control of Iraq's resources, which are phenomenal, and to reorganize the Middle East in U.S. and Israeli interests. That's called a conspiracy theory in the West. In the West, rational people understand that Washington and London would have been just as dedicated to the liberation of Iraq if its main exports happened to be lettuce and pickles and the world's energy resources were located in the South Pacific. Any respectable person knows that. Well, quite apart from the timing, faith in the miraculous conversion is a little difficult to sustain in view of the behavior of the missionaries just moments before. It's hard to recall any display of contempt for democracy as clear as the old Europe, new Europe distinction that was announced by Donald Rumsfeld shortly before the invasion and eagerly taken up by the media and the political class. The criterion distinguishing the two categories, old and new Europe, the criterion was sharp and clear. Old Europe, that's the bad guys, consisted of the countries where the governments took the same stand as a large majority of the population. While in New Europe, the hope for the future, governments overruled even larger majorities and took their orders from Crawford, Texas. Therefore, old Europe is to be disparaged, as it has been, and new Europe to be lauded as the hope for democracy and enlightenment. Again, conformity was close to 100%. Actually, I couldn't find a single deviation. Well, the most honored representative of New Europe was Spain's Prime Minister Aznar, and he was rewarded for his love of democracy by being invited to join Bush and Blair at the summit which announced the invasion of Iraq. That was shortly after polls in Spain showed that Aznar was backed in his support for the war by 2% of the Spanish population. This display of hatred for democracy reached its peak when the government of Turkey actually followed the will of 95% of the population, much to everyone's surprise, and rejected Washington's demands. Turkey was bitterly condemned in the national press for lacking what were called democratic credentials. Colin Powell, you recall the official dove, announced harsh punishment for this defection from good order. The most extreme was Paul Wolfowitz, who berated the Turkish military for not compelling the government to follow Washington's orders. He demanded that military leaders apologize to the United States and say, I'm quoting him, they're supposed to say, we made a mistake. Let's figure out how we can be as helpful as possible to the Americans. And that would demonstrate their understanding of democracy. So it's maybe small wonder that he was designated idealist in chief by David Ignatius of the Post, though he's not without flaws. Ignatius went on to say that he might be too idealistic, so much so that his passion for the noble goals of the war in Iraq might overwhelm the prudence and pragmatism that normally guide war planners. Actually, that's only one of innumerable accolades to this heroic figure whose passion is the advance of democracy, one of the most consistent themes of his career. I'm just selecting a few typical phrases from the elite liberal press. The accolades, and there were many, scrupulously ignored his record, which is one of consistent and appalling contempt for human rights and democracy. It goes back to his Reagan administration days and since. To mention just one example, he was perhaps the most enthusiastic supporter of General Suharto of Indonesia, and he actually persisted even after this grand mass murderer and torturer, who ranks with Saddam Hussein, even after he was abandoned by Washington when he committed his first crime in 1998, namely dragging his feet on IMF orders and failing to control the population. Wolfowitz, as you probably know, went on to become president of the World Bank, where his main mission was explained, press, as to control third world corruption. That's what the bank's now going to concentrate on. And he has real experience in that, just as much as with human rights and democracy. His great friend Suharto was ranked by Transparency International, which monitors international corruption. Suharto is ranked as far and away the most corrupt leader His robbery of the Indonesian people probably approximates their strangling, the debt that's strangling the country. The second one, I think, was Mobutu, who was way behind him. So this is all under Wolfowitz's tutelage and with his support, so he's in a good position to undertake that task, too. Meanwhile, Bush and company pursued their mission in the traditional domain of U.S. power, Latin America. In 2002, they supported a military coup to overthrow the elected government of Venezuela, but they had to slink away in the face of overwhelming opposition and condemnation in Latin America, where the population also seems to be deficient in their understanding of democracy, and therefore does not admire U.S.-backed military coups to overthrow elected governments. After a popular uprising restored the government, Washington turned to subversion under the natural guise of supporting democracy. That's what's now underway. And again, such actions by a foreign government within the United States would never be tolerated, particularly after they had just supported a military coup to overthrow the civilian government. But again, the imperial mentality allows them, in a traditional dependency, allows them to proceed without comment. Check and see. There's an official justification for this. The official justification is that the Chavez government in Venezuela is not democratic. And that's easily proven. Washington opposes it. Accordingly, it can have no relevance that Chavez has repeatedly won monitored elections and referenda despite bitter media hostility, nor does it matter that his popularity ratings are very high, or that Latin America's major polling organization recently found that while satisfaction with democracy continues its ominous decline throughout Latin America, there are a few exceptions. Leading the list of exceptions is Venezuela, where support for democracy climbed sharply to 75% through the Chavez years, and the country now leads Latin America in support for the elected government. Just a few days ago, polls released by the North American Opinion Research found that two-thirds of the population intend to vote for Chavez in the next election and 4% for the next highest candidate, the opposition candidate. But what Venezuelans think is plainly irrelevant. Our leader has spoken, so therefore the government's anti-democratic. Though the facts are not uncontroversial, actually these familiar patterns have, I should say, been followed elsewhere as well, not just in Latin America, but all over, including Central Asia, where the Bush administration has been an enthusiastic supporter of some of the world's most awful tyrants, torturers, and murderers. And that's not suppressed. The facts aren't controversial. They're reported. But there's an explanation. Quote the New York Times, they explain that in a region of bases, energy, and big power rivalries, ideals require patience. So we have to temper our passion for democracy and human rights with deep regret. Well, I won't run through the rest of the world, but again, urge you to do it, and I think you'll find consistent results. The strongest witnesses for the defense of the authenticity of the messianic mission should be the leading scholars and the most enthusiastic advocates of democracy promotion. The most prominent among them is the director of the Democracy and Rule of Law Project at the Carnegie Endowment, Thomas Carruthers, who identifies himself as a neo-Reaganite, agreeing with scholarship that Wilsonian idealism took on particular salience under Reagan's leadership. Just a year after the invasion of Iraq, just after the messianic mission had officially replaced the single question, Carruthers published a book reviewing the record of democracy promotion by the United States since the end of the Cold War. That's an interesting book. He finds what he calls a strong line of continuity running through all administrations in the post-Cold War era, including Bush number two, namely, democracy is promoted by the United States if and only if it conforms to strategic and economic interests. He finds that all administrations are schizophrenic, kind of psychological disorder of some kind, with very puzzling consistency. Well, Carruthers also wrote the standard scholarly work on democracy promotion in Latin America in the 1980s. Now, that he wrote in part from an insider's perspective. He was serving in the Reagan State Department in the programs of democracy enhancement. And Carruthers reviews the programs. He regards them as sincere, but he points out that they were a failure. And he's an honest scholar. He points out that they were a systematic failure, where U.S. influence was least in South America, progress toward democracy was greatest, despite Reagan's attempting to impede it by embracing right-wing dictators. Where U.S. influence was strongest, meaning the regions nearby, progress was least. And the reasons, Carruthers explained, are that Washington would tolerate only limited top-down forms of democratic change that did not risk upsetting the traditional structures of power with which the United States has been allied in quite undemocratic societies. So, in short, the strong line of continuity goes back a decade earlier, to the Reagan years, when the powerful idealistic element in traditional U.S. policy gained particular salience, according to scholarship. Nonetheless, the dedication of our leaders to the principle is beyond question, and today we must believe that Bush is dedicated to the messianic vision of creating a sovereign democratic Iraq and bringing democracy everywhere. Well, in fact, the strong line of continuity goes back much farther. Democracy promotion has always been proclaimed as a guiding vision, and it isn't even controversial that the U.S. regularly overthrew parliamentary democracies, often installing or supporting brutal tyrannies, Iran, Guatemala, Brazil, Chile, long list of others. There were Cold War pretexts, but they regularly collapse on the slightest investigation. Well, in his 2004 book, Carruthers predicted with regret that Washington's Iraq policies would extend the strong line of continuity. In his words, he feared that they will likely exhibit similar contradictions between stated principles and political reality. And in fact, those predictions were being fulfilled as his book went to press. The occupation authorities tried in every way they could to avert the threat of democracy in Iraq, but they were compelled with great reluctance to abandon their plans to impose a constitution and to prevent elections. Very few competent observers, none that I know, would disagree with the editors of the world's leading business newspaper, the London Financial Times, that the reason the elections took place was the insistence of the Grand Ayatollah Ali Sistani, who vetoed three schemes by the U.S.-led occupation authorities to shelve or dilute elections. The veteran Middle East correspondent Patrick Coburn, very knowledgeable and incidentally non-embedded, adds that it was only when it became clear that the United States could not withstand a Shia uprising that elections turned out to have been an American goal all along. In fact, the elections were a triumph of mass nonviolent resistance, which compelled the occupiers to allow them to take place, and then routinely, of course, took credit for them. Well, although compelled to tolerate elections, the occupying forces at once tried to subvert them, exactly as in Palestine in the past few months. There was a U.S. candidate, Iyad Alawi. He was given every possible advantage, state resources, access to television, support of the military occupation, and so on. And here too, as in Palestine, subversion was a resounding failure. Got about 12% of the vote. And Washington is now trying equally desperately to control the consequences, which isn't easy when U.S.-British polls indicate that 80% of the population wants a fixed timetable for withdrawal, and almost half approve of attacks against U.S.-British troops. And that's the whole country. Take a look at the Arab areas where they actually are. Figures are much higher. Well, to ensure that the elections would be free, the U.S. expelled the most important media from the country, notably the Qatar-based station Al Jazeera, which is despised by the ruling tyrants in the region because it's been a leading force for democratization in the Arab world. And that alone makes its presence before elections in Iraq inappropriate. And the background tells us a little more about the messianic mission. For years, high officials in the United States, Cheney, Rumsfeld, Rice, Powell, and others, have been pressuring Qatar to curtail Al Jazeera's reporting. The U.S. bombed its facilities in Kabul and Baghdad, killing a Jordanian correspondent there. U.S. pressure, now quoting the New York Times, U.S. pressure was so intense that the government of Qatar is accelerating plans to put Al Jazeera on the market, though Bush administration officials counter that a privately owned station in the region may be no better from their point of view. So we have another demonstration of Bush's vision of democracy in the Middle East. No media can be tolerated that are not under U.S. control, whether public or private. Well, without going on, it's dismally easy. It's clear enough that the Iraq calamity again illustrates the strong line of continuity, very much as Carruthers had anticipated, and that shouldn't be surprising given the unusual significance of Iraq in geopolitical and economic terms, and the fact, which should be obvious enough, that a sovereign and moderately democratic Iraq could easily turn into a nightmare for Washington, maybe the ultimate nightmare. I have to leave that one too as an exercise for the reader, but think it through. Beyond declarations of leaders and the self-refuting case of Iraq, several additional bits of evidence have been put forward to justify the faith and the sincerity of the messianic mission. The most heralded are Lebanon, Egypt, and Palestine. So let's turn to these. The case of Lebanon can be dismissed unless the CIA is taking credit for the bombing that killed Prime Minister Rafik Hariri, which set off the anti-Syrian demonstrations that did lead to a complex but significant opening of Lebanese society. Well, such speculations are hardly credible, but one could understand why they might have some resonance in Beirut. Perhaps Lebanese have not forgotten the most horrendous car bombing in Beirut. That was in 1985, an important year in the history of journalism. Now, that was the year when Middle East terrorism was ranked the most important story of the year in an annual poll of editors. The reason was, to look back, because of two cases in each of which one American was killed. The 1985 car bombing in Beirut in the same year, it caused a huge explosion, killing 80 people, wounding 200, most of them women and girls, leaving the mosque where the bomb was placed. The attack was aimed at a Muslim cleric who escaped. But that didn't figure in the poll of editors, and it's out of Western history and mainstream scholarship on terrorism and all journalism on terrorism. And the reason is very simple. The bombing was traced back to the CIA and Saudi intelligence, apparently with British help. Well, without pursuing the matter further, we can surely exclude Lebanon from the canon. So let's turn to Egypt. there is an important popular movement for change in opposition to the U.S.-backed Mubarak dictatorship. It's called Kifaya, Enough. It was formed in the year 2000. It was largely sparked by the Palestinian Intifada. The leading elements in the movement were the Palestinian Solidarity groups and continuing U.S.-backed Israeli atrocities in the occupied territories stimulated the Egyptian reform movement further, so its leaders point out, and it was then joined by the massive opposition to the war in Iraq. The spokesperson for Kifaya stresses that it is an anti-imperial movement with goals extending beyond the democratization of Egypt. So the democratization movement in Egypt doesn't look like a very good candidate for the sincerity of the messianic mission and its impact either. So let's turn finally to Washington's dedication to democracy promotion for Palestine. Here, as we see to the present moment, the strong line of continuity prevails, along with its paradoxical quality. Inexplicably, deeds consistently accord with interests and conflict with words. These discoveries must not, however, weaken our faith in the declaration of our leaders. And if that sounds like an unmentionable country, I can't help it. Bush proceeded to amplify his vision, as the press always calls it, by endorsing Israel's takeover of settlement blocks in the West Bank to solidify control over the regions that the U.S. and Israel are now effectively incorporating behind the separation wall. That's in defiance of a world court judgment reaffirming the conclusion of the Security Council and others that it violates international law. There was one dissent to the World Court ruling, U.S. Justice Bergenthal, but he dissented on very narrow grounds. He agreed with the court on the crucial issues. To quote Bergenthal's separate declaration, the Fourth Geneva Convention and international human rights law are applicable to the occupied Palestinian territory, and since all Israeli settlements in the occupied territories are in violation of the convention, the segments of the wall being built by Israel to protect the settlements are ipso facto in violation of international humanitarian law. It's about 85% of the wall, according to Human Rights Watch. And the same holds for the other U.S.-backed Israeli actions to take over valuable land and resources, leaving the area fragmented, uncontroversially, all blatantly illegal, in violation of the foundations of international humanitarian law, as just ruled again by the World Court unanimously. The actual meaning of the U.S.-Israeli programs is very clear from a look at the maps. If you look, you find that the basic plan includes two major salients extending from Israel through the West Bank. That creates three cantons, virtually separated, all of them virtually separated from whatever is to be left of Arab East Jerusalem, which is the center of Palestinian commercial, cultural, political life. It's where the institutions are, hospitals and everything else. The Israeli settlements and the massive infrastructure projects are to be incorporated within Israel with Bush's blessing, leaving the remaining fragments in Palestine unviable, with the expectation that the population will either leave or disappear from sight in something that may be called a state. And just recently it was formally announced that Israel will hold the Jordan Valley, from which Palestinians are being removed, in favor of subsidized Israeli settlers. That means that the remaining cantons will effectively be prisons, much like Gaza, which is described by Israeli human rights organizations as the world's largest prison. Well, there's no time here to review the diplomatic record during the 38 years of the occupation, but it is so consistent and so extensively documented that it takes real diligence and subordination to power not to see it and to comprehend it. The record reveals with dramatic clarity that throughout this whole period, over 30 years clearly, the U.S. has unilaterally barred an overwhelming international consensus on a two-state political settlement, and it still does more forcefully today than ever before, and now that it is guided by the president's inspiring vision. Actually, there's been one departure in this consistent rejectionism. Now, that was in January 2001. It's the last month of Clinton's administration. For 1 week in January, high-level Israeli and Palestinian negotiators met in Taba and came fairly close to reaching an agreement that was sort of approaching the long-standing international consensus. However, Israel called off the negotiations. The two parties then issued a joint statement declaring that they have never been closer to reaching an agreement, and it is thus our shared belief that the remaining gaps could be bridged with the resumption of negotiations. Well, negotiations were not resumed. Bush came in, but they did continue unofficially, and they led to the announcement of the Geneva Accord, as it's called, in December of 2002, was released in Geneva, based on discussions with high-level negotiators on both sides. Actually, the Geneva Accord came very close to the international consensus, which is overwhelmingly favored internationally, and is incidentally favored by a large majority of Americans. The Geneva Accord was welcomed publicly by most of the world. It was rejected by Israel, simply dismissed by Washington. There was a report about it in the New York Times, a very disparaging article, you know, who are these guys? We don't accept it, so goodbye. And it disappeared very quickly from the media here, although the efforts continue among Israelis and Palestinians. Well, the centerpiece for the Bush-Sharon programs for takeover of the West Bank, the centerpiece is presented as a Gaza disengagement plan that offers new hopes for peace. And that was a huge media frenzy last summer and fall, as you may recall, one of the big stories of the year. The actual motives for disengagement were pretty clear. Sane U.S.-Israeli rejectionists surely wanted Israel's illegal settlements removed from Gaza. It's been turned into a complete disaster area under the occupation. There are a few thousand Jewish settlers taking much of the land and the scarce resources and protected by a large part of the Israeli army. And that's absurd. And far more reasonable for U.S.-Israeli goals is to leave Gaza as a prison in which Palestinians can rot, cut off from contact with the outside and with few means of sustenance. And then when they riot or do something terrible, we can say, well, that just shows how bad Palestinians are, so obviously we can't deal with them. There was very little attempt to conceal the fact that the Gaza pullout was in reality an expansion plan. As the disengagement plan was made public, the Israeli government announced very publicly that Israel will invest tens of millions of dollars in West Bank settlements as it withdraws from the Gaza Strip. This was reported here, bolstering West Bank settlement blocks that are slated to be annexed to Israel under a final agreement and expanding the salients that fragment the territories. Harvard Mideast scholar Sarah Roy, who's maybe the leading academic specialist on the occupation, she writes that under the terms of the disengagement, Israel's occupation is assured. Gazans will be contained and sealed within the electrified borders of the Strip, while West Bankers, their lands dismembered by relentless Israeli settlement, paid for by the usual a kind donor, namely you, thanks to while relentless Israeli settlement will continue to be penned into fragmented geographic spaces, isolated behind and between walls and barriers. And that, she says correctly, appears unavoidable as long as the United States backs Israel's takeover of anything of value to it in the West Bank. Well, without proceeding, even the bare outlines make it clear enough that Palestine joins the other illustrations of Bush's messianic mission to bring peace and democracy and justice to the Middle East and the world. You may search for other examples to see if I've skipped some relevant ones. The persistence of the strong line of continuity to the present worldwide reveals that the United States is very much like other powerful states. It pursues the strategic and economic interests of dominant sectors of the domestic population to the accompaniment of impressive rhetorical flourishes about its exceptional dedication to the highest values. Now, that's practically a historical universal. I'm including the worst monsters, Hitler, Stalin, Mussolini, Emperor Hirohito. If we had records from Genghis Khan, we'd probably find the same thing. I can't find an example of a brutal monster or anyone else who didn't proclaim what is called American exceptionalism. It was probably believed by their own subjects. Well, that's the reason why nobody with a brain cell functioning pays the slightest attention to declarations of noble intent by leaders or accolades by their followers. They're predictable, and therefore they carry no information, I mean, even in the technical sense of information. There is a general guiding principle, and it's what I've illustrated and quoted. The guiding principle is that abroad, democracy is fine, but only as long as it takes the top-down form that does not risk popular interference with the primary interests of power and wealth. And in fact, very much the same doctrine holds internally. It's a topic that should be of very great importance to us and to the world, because what happens here has much broader significance because of the extraordinary power and influence of the United States. Well, there's no time to go into that, but I'd like to end with just a few words about the topic, because they, I think, provide some useful and simple ideas as to how to approach the grave problems that confront all of us. So here are a few suggestions. First, accept the jurisdiction of the International Criminal Court and the World Court. Second, sign the Kyoto Protocols and carry them forward. Third, let the United Nations take the lead in international crises. Fourth, rely on diplomatic and economic measures rather than military ones in confronting the grave threats of terror. Five, keep to the conventional interpretation of the United Nations Charter, conventional conservative interpretation, the use of just what its words say. The use of force is legitimate only when ordered by the Security Council or when the country is under imminent threat of attack until the Security Council can act. That's Article 51 of the Charter. Sixth, give up the veto at the Security Council and have a decent respect for the opinions of mankind, as the Declaration of Independence advises, even if power centers disagree. Seventh, cut back sharply on military spending and sharply increase social spending. Health, health, education, renewable energy, and so on. Actually, for people who believe in democracy, these are very conservative suggestions. And if there were any conservatives in the country, they'd all be in favor of them. Now, there's a very simple reason for it. These are the opinions of the majority of the U.S. population. in most cases, the overwhelming majority. They're in radical opposition to public policy, in most cases, a bipartisan consensus. Now, very few citizens are aware of these facts, and there's a reason. These are in-depth public opinion studies taken at very crucial moments by the most prestigious institutions, but they are scarcely reported, in some cases not reported at all, when they reveal facts like these, as they regularly do. And that record is highly instructive, especially for people who are interested in democracy promotion at home. Well, these are far from the only constructive suggestions that one can think of, but they're a pretty good start. And there are also, they can be supplemented with some simple truths that can be quite useful if we abide by them. One is to take democracy seriously. Another is to pay some attention to fact and elementary moral principle. Another is to refuse to accept the self-serving contention of the powerful that what happened in the past can be forgotten because we have undergone a miraculous change of course, something that happens every few years as easily demonstrated, and other simple truths. They don't answer every question by any means, but they do carry us a considerable way forward toward developing more specific and detailed answers, and more important, they open the way to implementing them, opportunities that are readily within our grasp if we can free ourselves from the shackles of doctrine and imposed illusion. Thanks. Okay, I can't see very well. Is there a mic out there? Two mics out there? Okay, well, the lights make it really hard to see, so I can't see hands. If there are mics, maybe the easiest thing would be if people went to the mics. It would save time. Okay? Okay, see one hand.
You mentioned the notion of imperial mentality. Would you comment on total spectrum dominance and weaponization of space?
Well, what's called full spectrum dominance, the question was to comment on full spectrum dominance and militarization of space in the context of the imperial mentality. Those are critical questions. Full spectrum dominance means exactly what it sounds like, and it's spelled out in detail in military Pentagon programs and so on. And I should say that although the Bush administration is at an extreme in advocating it, it's old-fashioned policy. Clinton administration was not much different. Had pretty much the same policies, just less brazen about them and less extreme. It means having the means to control the world in every possible way. That's, in fact, the main goal of what's called Rumsfeld transformation of the military. And I should say that it is very disturbing to high-level strategic analysts. The things that are being written about this in the most respectable, prestigious journals are astonishing. I've never seen anything like it. I mean, you can read one of the leading strategic analysts in the country, most respected in the Journal of the American Academy of Arts and Sciences, which breaks all records for respectability, in which he says that the transformation of the military to give full spectrum dominance carries, we're quoting him, carries with it an appreciable risk of ultimate doom. And he explains why. He hopes, and this bears on democracy in the United States, he expresses the hope that a coalition of peace-loving states will arise to counter U.S. policies which are leading probably to ultimate doom. Notice, if you look at it, you notice he doesn't call on the American people to do it. I guess the tacit assumption is that the democratic system is so totally eroded that you can't call on the American people to do it. What he does, he calls for a coalition, and he hopes it'll be led by China. Okay, we've come to a pretty pass when we read that in the most respected journals, and there's case after case like it, and there are good reasons. One of the reasons, which he mentions, as do many others, is what you pointed out, militarization of space. Militarization of space, everyone understands, is a step towards weaponization of space. If you want to know what weaponization of space means, it is not hidden. Just pick it up on the internet from, you know, Air Force planning documents, other Pentagon planning documents. What that means is putting in space means to attack any place in the world almost instantaneously without warning with lethal weapons, hypersonic planes that go in space and come down just to attack something, laser weapons, surely nuclear powered, other lethal weapons, any spot on the world, and you can do it anywhere you want because of global surveillance systems, which are supposed to be sophisticated enough so that you can tell if a car is going across the street in Ankara or wherever you happen to be aiming. Those are openly announced programs. The United States, 95% of current expenditures on space militarization are from the United States. And the U.S. programs are way more advanced than anyone else's. Undoubtedly, and this is part of the reasoning by John Steinbrenner and others who I quoted, undoubtedly, everyone knows, potential targets are going to react. They're not going to say, you know, please cut my throat. They're going to have a deterrent. And nobody's going to try to compete with the United States in military spending. Nobody's even close to that and doesn't want to try because they're not insane. If they try, it would be the end of the species almost instantly. So they're not going to try. So what they're going to do is develop the kinds of deterrents that are cheap. And there are basically two. One of them is terror, and the other is nuclear weapons. Not nuclear weapons on the scale of the United States, but enough to make an attack costly, make them think twice. And that's just what's happening. Bush's transformation of the military quickly, as anticipated, led to Russia's sharply increasing its offensive military capacities and military spending, new sophisticated missiles and weapons aimed at the United States as a deterrent. And it's now the reason that Steinbrenner hope that the coalition would be headed by China is that of all the powerful states, China has been the most restrained in military spending and in developing offensive weapons. That's practically none. But and it's been the leader in the UN in trying to block the militarization of space. The U.S. has completely blocked the UN Disarmament Commission, which has been trying to extend the Outer Space Treaty, which reserves space for peaceful means. The U.S. alone has blocked it. It's been going on actually since the Clinton years, but more extensively since Bush. That's why it's going on China. And China is now responding too, increasing military spending, developing a deterrent. That means offensive weapons aimed at the United States. Nowhere near the other major powers, but it's doing it and will continue. That's a predictable consequence of the transformation of the military, as every analyst knows. One of the most threatening things is what's called missile defense. Missile defense is part of the militarization and weaponization of space. On every side, people understand that missile defense is a first strike weapon. No other purpose for it. Everyone understands that. And therefore, I mean, as long as the missile defense program is criticized in the United States, and it's criticized because it's not going to work. But probably it won't, but that's the wrong criticism. The criticism is it might work, or it might look as though it's going to work. And potential targets are going to have to make a worst case analysis. If there's any indication that it might work, potential targets, like, say, China, will quickly step up their efforts to develop means to destroy it, to overcome it, which happen to be a lot cheaper and easier than missile defense and aimed right at the United States. All of this is putting us, the world, at risk of short-term total destruction. And that is not overlooked. And that's why you get Robert McNamara talking about apocalypse soon, and why you get one of the few remaining conservative senators, Sam Nunn, who's been in the lead of trying to cut back this madness. It was why he writes articles saying we're facing an Armageddon of our own making. I mean, the effect of all of this, which is well understood, is that potential adversaries, Russia and China, if China does it, India will do it. If India does it, Pakistan will do it, and then it goes. We're forcing them to develop an offensive military capacity aimed at the United States and on hair trigger alert, because there isn't going to be any time for judgment. That means automated response systems. Well, we don't know much about their systems, but we know a lot about ours, which are much more sophisticated, have hundreds of errors. Hundreds of computer errors have been reported. Fortunately, they've all been aborted by human intervention. There's a couple of minutes to human analysis to see if, you send off missiles and end the world. And then I think the president has like 30 seconds to make a decision, something like that. Well, their systems are way worse than ours are. Much more, less sophisticated, more, especially in Russia, the economy's totally collapsed. So what we're doing is it's suicidal, not just for us, but for the world. It's not my opinion. It's the standard opinion of the strategic analysis literature. And remarkably little attention is being given to it. It's important that you brought it up. I think it's the leading issue on the international agenda. I have a book coming out in which the first chapter is all about it. I've written about it before. It's just unbelievable that it's not being discussed. It's the leading crisis that we face. And it's a crisis of survival. And that's well understood. So, thanks for bringing it up.
Your critics have called you un-American, and I was just wondering, how do you define American, and how do you respond to that?
How do I define?
American.
American?
Yeah. You've had critics who've said that your policy, your ideas or your thoughts on American foreign policy and Israel's foreign policy have been un-American. How do you define American, and how do you respond to your critics?
Well, I'm very happy to be attacked by people whose models are the most vulgar Soviet commissars. What you think, that's true. I mean, every dissident. Think about it. Every dissident in the Soviet Union was criticized in exactly the same terms. In fact, the worst condemnation was anti-Soviet. Like you criticize something going on in Russia, you're anti-Soviet or you're counter-revolutionary or something like that. Yeah, it's okay, that's the behavior of the commissar class. If people want to imitate it here, that's their right. Actually, the phrase anti-Israel has an interesting history. If any of you have had a good Jewish education like I have, the origins. The phrase hater of Israel comes from the Bible. It was used by the man who was the epitome of evil in the Bible, King Ahab, the worst monster. He called the prophet Elijah a hater of Israel because Elijah was criticizing the acts of the evil king. And the king, like every totalitarian since, identifies himself with the people, the culture, the society, and so on. So if you condemn the acts of the evil king, you're a hater of Israel. Yeah. That runs right through history up till today. And what you're talking about is one manifestation of it. That's a leading theme of intellectual history, to support state violence, power, and terror by condemning anyone who criticizes it or questions it as a hater of the country on the totalitarian principle that you identify the state with the country, the people, the culture, and so on. In fact, the very term un-American or anti-American is drawn from the lexicon of totalitarianism. And it's astonishing that it's even used. As far as I know, there's no country outside the United States and various tyrannies where there is such a concept. Like if somebody criticizes, say, Berlusconi in Italy, Suppose someone were to call him anti-Italian. You know, people would collapse in ridicule. They wouldn't know where to laugh and cry. In any culture, in any society that has a kind of a democratic culture, it would be looked at as absurd. The fact that it can be used here should concern us. And we know the origins, and we know what it means.
Professor Chomsky, the portrait that you've painted of the world is indeed a gloomy one. And most of the people here agree with most of what you've said, although I'm sure not everyone. But what we may not be in agreement with is the age-old question of what is to be done. I wonder if you could give us your wisdom on some strategies of resistance, and also that tension between what is right strategically and what is right ethically to be done.
What is right?
Ethically.
And what is right?
And strategically.
Strategically.
And, well, and in addition to that, your views on civil disobedience.
Yeah. Well, take the last case. You know, civil disobedience is a tactic, not a principle. I mean, I've been involved in it all my life, lots of times, in and out of jail, so on and so forth. I don't think it's sometimes right, it's sometimes wrong, you know, like other tactics. You just have to ask. As for what is to be done, it seems to be obvious. I mean, I ended with some simple suggestions, very conservative suggestions. Take the opinion of the large majority of the population seriously. I mean, if you're a journalist, publish it, okay? So a lot of... let me give the sources of what I was quoting. I happen to be quoting from major public opinion studies by the leading, most prestigious institutions in the country, Program for International Policy Attitudes, based in the University of Maryland, Chicago Council for Foreign Relations, the usual monitor on international affairs, and others, which the press knows perfectly well. They are the most careful students, prestigious studies, look at their websites and so on. I was quoting from two polls. One of them was released about 2 months before the presidential elections. And what it showed was that both political parties were far to the right of the population on a whole host of major issues, like the ones I mentioned. Well, I think it was reported in, I think there were two local newspapers that reported it. I don't think it was a word in the national press. A couple of op-eds here and there. One exception, Newsweek had an op-ed about it. That's the only exception beyond a couple local newspapers. The second poll that I was referring to, and I'm sure there'll be another one pretty soon, so you might keep your eyes open for it. The second one was taken right after the federal budget was announced in February 2005. Okay, right after that, major studies asking people what they thought about the budget. And the results were very interesting. I mean, I just kind of hinted at them. But what they showed is that what the public wants by overwhelming majorities is almost the inverse of the budget. Like where the budget's going up, public wants to go down. Where the budget's going down, public wants to go up in case after case. And by large margins, and also by large amounts. Also on other things, which I didn't mention. So an overwhelming majority of the public wants Bush's tax cuts rescinded for people over with over $200,000 income. I mean, that's kind of all of the tax cuts. When that's ever mentioned in the press, it's called, you know, sacrosanct. Can't touch it, you know. And it's the same on issue after issue. Well, that one I actually did ask a friend to do a database search on in the LexisNexis database. He couldn't find one single newspaper, even some local newspaper in a small town in Idaho that reported it. I mean, that's real discipline. It's important. It's important to keep people in ignorance. I mean, if each person thinks I'm some kind of a nut, you know, everybody else says something else, well, okay, they're not going to do anything about it. If people think, well, yeah, what I think is what everybody thinks, then they'll go out and do something about it. So the first thing to do is let people know what the facts are. That's not hard, you know, it's like not a very radical suggestion. And the next suggestion is also extremely conservative. You know, turn the rascals out. There's a huge gap between public policy and public opinion. And the fact that we even ask the question what we can do about it is remarkable. I mean, take a look at other countries in the hemisphere. I mean, let's say, take the poorest countries in the hemisphere, like, say, Bolivia. I mean, they didn't ask, what can we do? I mean, they actually had a democratic election of a kind that we can't even dream of, you know? I mean, you know, you may like the outcome or hate it, but there's no doubt that it was a real democratic election. I mean, a large majority of the population, first of all, there were issues. Here, the issues are out of the election, almost nobody knows what they are. But there were issues, everybody knew what they were. The large majority of the population was able to elect a candidate from their own ranks. You know, poor peasant. I mean, you know, it's not like what we call an election is two rich guys who went to Yale and joined the same secret society and, you know, backed by the same corporations and have the same policies, which are kept away from the public because you're not allowed to talk about issues. We call that an election. Well, do we have to be stuck with that? I mean, you know, the idea that we can't do what people can do in Bolivia, I mean, it's just mind-boggling. Of course we can do anything we like. You know, we have an incredible legacy of freedom and privilege, which is shared nowhere in the world. And it wasn't any kind of a gift. I mean, it was won by struggles by people who didn't ask, what can we do? But went ahead and did it. And, you know, it gives us a basis for carrying it forward. So the fact is, you know, opportunities to do anything we like. So I don't really understand I'm constantly asked the question, I should say. In fact, this is no scientific sample, but if you want my opinion, just personal experience, you know, innumerable talks all over the world, discussions, you know, 6 hours of answering email every night where it comes up over and over. I think there's an interesting correlation. Somebody might want to study it. The correlation seems to be pretty generally that the sense of helplessness correlates with the level of opportunity. Okay, the more opportunity you have, the more helpless you feel. Like, you know, peasants in southern Colombia or Bolivia or some, you know, refugees in Turkey or something, they never ask, what can we do? They tell you what they're doing and they ask if you can help. When you get to the more wealthy and privileged sectors of a society, then people start feeling helpless. And I think it's an accurate judgment, but check it out. And if it is, I think there's a pretty good explanation for it. The people who are more wealthy and privileged are much more intensely indoctrinated. I mean, they are the targets of the indoctrination system, the main ones. Poor people are kind of left alone. Being targets of and one of the main themes of indoctrination is you're helpless. Nothing you can do. It's all like an avalanche going on out there. You don't have any choices. All you can do is watch. Besides, you're alone because nobody else thinks the way you do. So you're alone. You don't talk to your neighbors. Your only job in life is to buy more consumer goods. So just shut up and let us run things. And if you don't like the way it goes, it's your problem. There's something wrong with you. I mean, that's just, we're deluged with that from infancy. And it has its effects. It makes the most privileged people in the world feel that they're helpless. And you got to overcome that. You know, we have every possibility of overcoming it. So I don't think there's any problem in what you can do. You can start with very conservative proposals, like the ones I mentioned, and you can go on from there.
Thank you very much, Professor Chomsky. We're going to move to a town hall forum, and though I agree with every one of his proposals, maybe some grassroots activism is what is in store, so I'm going to turn over to Professor Ugarte, who's going to bring in some local community groups that are working for change here. I hope that you guys can meet, greet, and work forward from this date. Have a great night.